Hello, it's Pastor Warren Hoyt with you again, discussing this great book by Dr. J. Richards, Money, Greed, and God. A very important book for our times. When we see people protesting in the streets saying that capitalism must go, saying how evil it is, we hear even some prominent Christians speaking against capitalism. We see millions of people voting for a socialist. There is confusion in our time about economics and about some of the very historical developments that made us the people that we are today. So this book is very helpful in that respect, that it really opens our eyes to a lot of things. And I really thank Dr. Richards for writing it. He deals in the book with eight myths that are very commonly believed by many people, including Christians. And we've been looking at those. The first myth was the Nirvana myth, which compares capitalism with some supposed ideal system out there that doesn't even really exist. The second myth is called the piety myth, the idea that good intentions are what really count, not results. The third myth is called the zero-sum game myth. It's the idea that if some win, others must have to lose. Then there was the materialist myth, the idea that wealth is static, it only changes hands. If some people have wealth, then they must be taking it from others. Last time we looked at the greed myth, that the essence of capitalism is pure greed. Today we're going to look at the sixth myth, the usury myth, which is believing that working with money is inherently immoral or that charging interest on money is always exploitive. That's what the word usury means. It's the idea of gathering, of getting interest on a loan. The title of chapter six is, Hasn't Christianity Always Opposed Capitalism? And so Richards is going to address that. Hasn't Christianity always opposed capitalism? And he's going to show us the answer in this chapter. He begins by talking about how, as a boy, he earned money gathering pop bottles and so on. And so when he got about $100, his dad had him open his first ever bank account. And he took him out of school and everything. And wanted to teach him about banking, about saving, about interest and all that. And Jay said he was really amazed to learn about this compound interest thing. And he realized that he could put this money in the bank and it would just accumulate more and more interest until he was a millionaire or until he needed a new bike, whichever came first. And well, as you might guess, his need for the bike did come first. But anyway, the point is, we're all very accustomed to interest today, and it's a good thing. We teach our children about it. People have 401ks, bank accounts, we earn interest, we have stocks and bonds maybe, we buy things on credit, we pay with credit cards, and we don't lie awake at night worrying about whether we're going to go to hell because of that. Well, you know what? For centuries, that wouldn't have been the case. Why? Because for centuries, most Christian thinkers, theologians, pastors, leaders, they taught that usury was sin and that people who made money with money would be in one of the lowest levels of hell. Dante's Inferno has money changers in one of the lowest levels of hell. Why did they believe this way? Well, the scriptures themselves seem to teach that usury, charging interest on loans, is sin. Let me give you some examples. Exodus 22:25 says the Israelites were not to loan money to their own people at interest. Leviticus 25:35-37 says that if an Israelite were to fall into difficult times, the other Israelites were not to loan him money at interest. They could loan to foreigners at interest, Leviticus 23:19-20, but never to their brothers. Even Psalm 15, which says, "Who may abide on God's holy hill?" speaks about loaning money. Because it says that a person who's going to dwell with God is he who does not loan money to his brethren at interest. That's Psalm 15, verses 1 and 5. In the New Testament, Jesus said, we should loan to people without expecting anything back. Luke 6:34-35. Richard says, hey, you know what? That's not exactly something you'd inscribe and granted over the entrance to the Bank of America. But he said it. We know also that Jesus drove the money changers out of the temple in John 2:13-16. And we know that Paul said the love of money was the root of all evil, 1 Timothy 6:10. So there's a scriptural background, a scriptural basis for the Christian scholars of the early and the medieval church to speak and write against usury. They also, you know, the church developed in a Greco-Roman thought world. And in that world, usury was condemned. Greek philosophers like Plato and Aristotle condemned it. Romans like Cato, Cicero, Seneca, they condemned it. Even later on, Buddha and Muhammad condemned usury. Islam still does to this day. Basically, everyone condemned it. The question is why? Why did they think this way, that it was just inherently evil? There must be a reasonable explanation, right? It couldn't just be the Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it. Not for all these people. And importantly also, what happened to change the Christian view of all this so that today we don't think of it as sin? Are we wrong to not think of it as sin? Should we feel guilty for making interest on our money? Well, J. Richards gives an answer to this in the sixth chapter of his book. And interestingly, I've mentioned before, but Dr. Rodney Stark also gives a very similar explanation in his book, The Victory of Reason. And when I find various scholars saying the same thing, it really tends to reinforce that we're on the right track. And these men are all saying that what changed is the development, the historical developments, in other words, are what caused a change in the view toward loaning money. Over a period of centuries, the development of capitalism simply forced everyone in the Western world to rethink it, to reevaluate how they looked at money, loans, interest, on all that. You see, in biblical times, and all the way up through the Middle Ages, face it, most people lived agricultural lives, and the vast majority of people were basically subsistence farmers. They were either poor or on the verge of poverty. Now, money existed. You know, you see these ancient coins and so forth with the emperor stamped on them. But money was a static sort of commodity. And only a very small percentage of people had any extra money. If they did, they would store it out and, you know, bury it in a chest out in the backyard or put it under their bed someplace. No one used money to make money. So the only time anybody would need to borrow money would be in a time of crisis, when the crops fail, there's a war, an illness, something of that sort. And so in a case like that, a person with wealth would be loaning to a person who was in a real crisis, a real desperate situation. And the money that the wealthy person would loan would otherwise just have been collecting dust somewhere. So in that kind of a scenario, to charge interest would be to take advantage of a poor brother when he's in trouble, kick him while he's down. It would be greedily making a profit off of another person's misfortune. That is why God forbade it in the Bible. Because the money that would be loaned, you weren't doing with it anything with it anyway, and yet now you're going to actually charge your poor brother interest? This would have been atrocious. This would have been just seen as an absolute abomination, right? What happened was, around about the 12th century, the economic environment began to change drastically. Trade began to expand. There was a division of labor. There was higher productivity from the farms. That led to an expansion in wealth. Remember in earlier chapters, we're talking about how some people think that wealth is like a pie, and if you have a big slice, that means other people get slimmer slices. But we learned that that's not true. What actually is happening throughout history is that the so-called pie is growing bigger and bigger. So that's what was beginning to happen in around the 12th century. And at that time, up to that time, coins were the only money that you used. There began to be a shortage of them because of the increase in business. And because people did business from country to country, they began to encounter difficulties in, you know, sending payments from one country to another. There were all kinds of unethical practices, like people would take coins and shave a little bit off of them and then make other coins from what they shaved. And people would mix lesser metals with the coins and reprint them and so on. So coins began to be less and less reliable. Not only that, but if you sent coins on a, you know, over the mountain passes or whatever, there could be robbers up there who would ambush and steal the money. So what happened is the development of banks. Banks were created as a way of resolving some of these issues. And they began to spread, and banks developed branches in faraway cities. And this was a way of resolving problems. A buyer in Italy, for example, who wanted to buy wool from Flanders, which is modern-day Belgium. Instead of sending bags of gold along the road up there to pay for it, they could just go to the local bank in northern Italy and deposit their gold or silver, and then that bank would send what was called a bill of exchange to the branch in Flanders to verify that the money was in Italy. So then the wool merchant in Flanders would be shown that. He would receive money from the bank in Flanders, and then records would be sent back to Italy. So all that was exchanged then was the paperwork, the records. Nothing that anybody could rob along the way. So the people who were despised as crooks in earlier times, the money exchangers, the people who kept records and all that, began to become, they became more and more important people, more esteemed people. They kept the records, and the money was moved between merchants and buyers without all the dangers and difficulties of transporting silver and gold. So the development of banks changed money from being a static commodity to being a tool for the expansion of business and wealth. And when you began to have this money stored up in banks, the bankers began to realize that, hey, they could loan some of this money out and they could make something off of it. And so business people of all kinds began to borrow money from banks. They borrowed it in order to invest it and make money. There was risk to the bankers in loaning the money. And also when they loaned the money out, it wasn't in their possession anymore to make money with it. And so therefore, it was only right for them to charge interest to make up for what they would otherwise be doing with the money. And it was only right for the borrowers to pay interest because they were borrowing the money, not because they were in a crisis. They were borrowing the money to make money with it. And it was only right for them to have to pay for that. So society began to change drastically in these ways, and loans became more common. Around this time, insurance was also developed. The idea that, hey, you know, if you send your merchandise on a ship, it might sink on the way, then you'll lose everything. Instead, why don't you pay me, and I'll get all the business people to pay me, and I'll store up money, and I'll make money. If the ship doesn't sink, I'll make money. If the ship does sink, I pay you off, but I still make money because I'm gathering it from everybody. So the whole insurance industry came about. And that was, again, making money on money. Even the numeric system changed from Roman numerals to Hindu Arabic numerals. So over time, finance and banking became more and more representational and immaterial. Money was no longer static. It had a time value. It could become more valuable over time. These developments caused everybody, including church leaders, to change their views on loaning money. It was no longer loaning to a poor neighbor in crisis. Money had become something people used to make more money. And so it was only natural over time for theologians and scholars, church leaders, to see these things and realize how life was changing and to begin to understand there was a great big difference between loaning money for business and the practice of usury, which was taking advantage of somebody in dire straits. Great reformers like John Calvin were quick to understand that and to change the church's teachings on loans and so forth. Some people act like the church did this because they were greedy and they just wanted to justify their greediness and justify making money, but really it's not that. They did it because the whole system had changed. In spite of that, today, there's still a lot of people, including a lot of Christians, who just have negative thoughts about bankers, capitalists, capitalism, and all that. And we see this in the protests in the streets. Jay Richards cites a Christian feminist website that says that Jesus would never be a Wall Street trader, a banker for a large national or international banking conglomerate, or participate in the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund. And you got to just ask, really? Who says such a thing? Who says working with money is inherently more evil than any other profession? Where do these people get this idea? They get it from some ancient view or some sort of a feeling they have, but it's not based on fact. So here's the main point of chapter 6. Many think that Christianity was always opposed to capitalism and hindered its development, and they take that as a justification for being opposed to it today. But the truth is that for 1,000 years, everyone was opposed to charging interest on money, and everyone thought it was immoral. What's different about the Christian West is that the West was able to recognize the changes in how money was handled and adapt to them. Christianity redefined its views on these things, while other societies did not. And there's a growing number of scholars today who have come to the realization that capitalism actually developed in the Christian West rather than anywhere else in the world. Rather than being opposed to it, Christianity contributed to its development and adapted itself to the new situation. What about all those scriptures we looked at the beginning, the Old Testament and the New? Guess what? If you look at them all closely in the light of what we've been talking about here, it becomes very plain to see that in each case, the Bible isn't condemning banks and loans and interest as we understand these things today. Rather, it's condemning greediness, hard-heartedness, materialism in general, and the idea of turning ministry into a way of making money specifically. So Richards ends the chapter saying this, quote, "We must distinguish what the Bible actually says from what we assume it ought to say. Unfortunately, as we've seen, when it comes to economics, pious assumptions too often replace careful reading and careful thinking." You know, that's just so true. And it's why I thought it was important to share this great book with you so that we could come to some understanding about these things. Next time, we'll look at the seventh myth, which Richards calls the artsy myth, the idea of confusing aesthetic judgments with economic arguments. He titles his chapter, "Does Capitalism Lead to an Ugly Consumerist Culture?" I can tell you, lots of people today think so. I sure hope you'll tune in for that discussion. Until then, may the Lord richly bless you.